Okay, good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about redo logging in file systems. And one kind of strange thing we mentioned is that a lot of file systems don't use redo logging for everything. They've just made a decision that, yeah, there's a cost to writing things in the log and then elsewhere, and we don't want to pay that for everything, even though it's going to make the state of the file system weirder after we have an abnormal shutdown. Then we started talking about distributed systems. We first looked at, well, what are ways of organizing multiple machines to do one task? And we had sort of two extremes. We had the client-server model, where clients would contact servers, servers would reply to clients, and we had these two very different roles. We had the peer-to-peer model, where everyone was kind of equal. And, I said those are two extremes. Obviously, we could come up with something in between, and maybe that's something we do. We're mostly going to look at versions of the client-server model. And we mentioned that it's not strictly going to be one layer of clients and servers. We might sort of repeat this model in practice, is like combine it multiple times to build our system. We looked at reasons to use distributed systems. We mentioned that one reason was just a social one that like machines were owned by different people. We wanted to coordinate. And we had other reasons about reliability. We wanted to handle one machine not working or scaling that we wanted to add machines to add capacity rather than having to upgrade to a bigger and bigger and better machine. Once we talked about sort of high-level organization, we looked at from kind of abstract point of view how we actually send data around in one of these distributed systems. And we had sort of two models for communication. So our simplest model was this mailbox model that we could send messages on the network addressed to someone, they would get into their mailbox, a program could pick it up from that mailbox. And we had a more featureful model of a connection model that we'd somehow establish a link, kind of like making a phone call to another machine, and we could send messages back and forth, and they'd be tied to each other, kind of like things we say in a phone call. And we mentioned, though we didn't go into the details, that you can implement this connection model on top of the mailbox model. So once we had these communication models, we had to ask the question of, well, how do I actually make this usable inside of my system? How do I like make it so someone can actually like specify what machine to talk to and so on? And we started out by pointing out this distinction that we've actually seen before between names and addresses. So that distinction is that names are sort of our logical labels, things that are kind of human useful, and addresses are what we need under the hood to actually find the resource we're looking for. And resource could be like a value in memory, or it could be a machine on the network, or a service on a, an application on a particular machine. And we had the most visible part of this dichotomy between host names, names for machines, which were stored in this domain name system and needed to be mapped to addresses, which were these numbers that routers actually understood on networks to see where do I send this message addressed to someone to make it keep going. And we had a sort of similar idea with services on a machine. We'd have these names like HTTP, but we actually assigned them numbers, which we called port numbers, to distinguish between different services on the same machine. So once we talked about this connection model and how we identify machines, we needed some way of actually sort of providing an interface to programs to use these connections. And we talked about POSIX choice, which is that connections would appear as file descriptors, which makes sense because everything else that we wanted to expose to programs, we kind of used files. And we had some special extra operations in order to set up sockets. But once they were set up, they kind of worked like a pipe, but a pipe that worked in both directions. And these operations were bind, which would set the local address for that socket. So it would say, you know, if someone's trying to contact me using the socket, what are they going to send over the network to do that? We had accept, which was, if I'm a server, I want to make a new connection that someone's trying to make with me. And this gives us a new file descriptor. So each connection has its own file descriptor. When we make a server, we make this special server socket that produces new file descriptors for each individual connection. As a client, of course, we have to somehow contact the server and say, I want to have a connection with you. And we did that with this connect operation, which transforms our client file descriptor from not being set up to being the descriptor that's connected to a particular server. So questions about these things from last time. We'll finish up a little talking about sockets. Questions about any of this before we move on. Okay, so when we were talking about sockets, we like very briefly showed sort of this high level view of what do we actually like do with this connect, bind, and socket operation. And I'm going to show sort of a more complicated version. So on this client, same as last time, we get a socket, we create a socket, then we connect it to a particular place. And then we read and write from that, kind of like it were a pipe, until we're done, then we close it. On the server side, we create a socket, we bind it to specify, hey, I know clients need to contact me, let me specify how they're going to ask for me by specifying a host and port. We listen for connections and then accept new connections. And in the previous version of this, I said we accept a connection, we read and write from it, we close it, then we accept a new connection. And that has a bit of a problem that, gosh, we want to actually have our like web server serve multiple clients at a time. How can we do that? Well, remember, each time we accept, we get a new file descriptor. So that means we can use that new file descriptor in a new process or a new thread. And this is sort of a common way of structuring servers. You know, or we can use, event loops, but with multiple file descriptors. And while we're, however we do things concurrently, while we're reading and writing to this connection, we can also be accepting another connection so we can handle multiple clients at once. This is sort of the simplest way of structuring a server that handles multiple clients at once with the sort of POSIX socket design. So questions about anything in this diagram? So one thing that we were kind of missing is I mentioned that we have this bind and this connect call where we specify a host and port, and I could kind of specify how that works. And one thing that's a little tricky is that connect and bind, the actual POSIX operations, require an address and a port number, but we mentioned that that's not what we logically want to specify. So POSIX also provides a way to translate names to addresses. And the primary one, well, maybe not the primary, the one I recommend is get adder info. And basically the way this works is that you pass the, you know, www.cs.virginia.edu and HTTP to this, and you get the stuff you need to pass to bind or connect, depending on what you're doing. And this handles that whole translation process for you. That's sort of one little missing piece that we, So bind plus connect, expect addresses, not names. And this is handles that disconnect. Allows us to use names, which is like kind of what we want when we're writing code. So one last thing that I'm going to mention about POSIX sockets is, so far I've talked about using these sockets to communicate over the internet, like between machines, and that seems certainly like what they're most useful for, and certainly like what sounds like the most common reason we want to do this. But POSIX defines multiple classes of sockets that have the same interface, but they use different kinds of addresses. And one kind it defines are what are called local domain or Unix domain sockets that only work on the local machine. And you might say, gosh, why is that useful? Why are sockets that let me contact strictly less things, it seems, useful? But this is actually used all the time. So one example is on most Unix systems, we have a program that manages displaying things on the screen, and applications need to talk to that program, and we use a client-server model for that. That program is a server that other applications on the machine, like your text editor that's displaying a window with code in it, is a client. And so the way this works is that, when they want to display a window, they connect to this via a socket, and they say, hey, make a window for me via the socket and make all those arrangements. And since these are only on a local machine, rather than using something like port numbers, these local sockets use a file that appears like a file on disk. So kind of like we talked about device files being something that would let you access some device, we have files that let you access a socket, so they can have a name and a location on disk. That makes sense. And we use the file system to handle the mapping from name to address. So this is actually like really common, and maybe like on a Linux system, the most common use of sockets, more so than a web browser. And we're going to have an assignment where we're going to write some sort of mini distributed system thing, and we're going to use local sockets. You're not going to use the POSIX API. We're going to use something called RPC, which we'll talk about later today. But we're going to use Unix local sockets to make it so you can test locally, which is another big good use of these, is that you don't want to have things exposed on the internet. Well, now you can test locally and not worry about conflicts. So the way the APIs for this works are that you specify a special type of address, and you say, hey, I want a Unix socket to the create a socket file descriptor, and you pass this special type of address in to the connect call or to the bind call. And in the address, you literally specify a file. Because it's local, we can just do that. And as I said, these are like super common. So NetStat, I showed you earlier, can show me about internet connections from my machine. It also shows sort of all these local sockets that are set up on my machine. You can see they have file names. So we have UDEV, which is a service for handling, setting up device files on behalf of programs. We have CUPS, which is a printing service. So if a program wants to print, they open this socket up and say, hey, I'd like to print this, and a whole bunch of other things that are active on our machine. This here, X11, that's the display driver I mentioned, display program I mentioned earlier. This is happening all the time and a very common pattern on Unix-like systems for, communicating between programs. So that's all I have to say about sockets. So before I move on to our next topic, which is going to be sort of a layer of abstraction of top sockets, any questions about anything remaining with sockets? Okay. So, our next topic is going to be an interface that's more abstract than sockets and arguably more useful, and it turns out is really common in industry. And this is something called remote procedure calls. And sort of the high-level goal here is that with sockets, we kind of have to specify how, exactly what messages we send and interpret them. And, that's not actually how we write programs typically. Typically, when I'm like using a library, I just call a bunch of functions and get results. And we'd like to kind of expose a remote machine like a server as a library, where we just get a bunch of functions and they run on the remote machine. We call them like we would call library functions. And this is what the goal of remote procedure calls is that I, as the server author, write a bunch of functions. Then from a client, I can call those functions and they actually get called in the remote machine. And there's going to be some infrastructure that handles all the details of making this happen. So the result is going to be we're going to get remote procedure calls. And our goal is a common goal with distributed systems, something I'll call transparency. That these remote procedure calls, the hope is look like local function calls, local procedure calls, like normal local function calls in your favorite programming language. And this hope appears all the time in distributed systems and is called transparency. So it's the reason it's called transparency is that you can like see through the system being distributed as if it's not, all the boundaries between machines are just, clear glass, which there's no difference you can observe. And this is a great goal and we're not going to be able to do it. We're going to get kind of close, maybe not really that close, but we're not going to actually be able to do it. But this is sort of the goal we have in mind. So let's keep that in mind as we're looking at what we're going to do to actually, provide something like local call function calls becoming calls to a remote machine. So as I mentioned, we have this tool or library that handles the details. And we want to have something where we can make a function call or something that looks like a function call and have it do something else. Well, how do we do that? The simplest answer is let's actually make a function call locally, but instead of, we can't call the remote machine directly. Instead, we're going to call what we'll call a stub. So this some tool is going to generate a wrapper function for us that's going to stand in for the remote machine. So if I'm calling a remote procedure, I make a local procedure call to a stub, which is a local procedure stub. And the stub here is a local procedure. So we call it like a local procedure. And hopefully it has the same prototype as the remote procedure, so the call looks exactly the same, except we're calling a slightly different function. And we're also going to have a stub at the other end. So, what's the easiest way for my server to have one of its functions called? Well, write some code that actually calls it. So our tool is going to write code to do that, which is going to be something we'll call a stub on the server that calls the server code. So sort of the way this is going to work, our client program is going to make a function call to this client stub. The client stub is going to talk to an RPC library, which makes some choices about how do we actually communicate to the remote machine, and using probably sockets, it's going to talk to the RPC library running and the server on the other machine, which is going to use the stub to make the correct kind of function call on the remote machine. So what are these stubs? So the client stub is typically going to be generated by a compiler-like tool. So as part of this RPC system, we'll have a library, but we'll also have a code generation tool, which is going to look at what are the functions you want to call and generate code that matches those. So that, and this is going to have a wrapper function, so which is going to serve the purpose of having the same prototype. And also, because we know what the arguments are, it's going to have the code to convert the arguments to bytes. Why do we need to do that? Because over here, this needs to be bytes. That's what we can send over sockets. And the function call, we have like structs or something. So all that conversion work needs to happen here, because it's going to be specific to what the arguments to our function is. And the idea is that when we make this wrapper function, we can take that into account. We also are going to end up needing to do the reverse translation, that we're going to get bytes here, which is the return value of the function, and need to translate that to whatever the function actually returns. You know, maybe it's a struct or a string or something like that. We need to make that happen. On the server side, we're going to have a stub that, again, is generated by a compiler-like tool. And this is going to contain an actual function call and also do the inverse of that arguments to bytes conversion that was done in the client stub. So the code that generates the client and server stub needs to, you know, have coordinated about what is the format we're going to actually send to the RPC library. So in the RPC library, I mentioned we're going to send sort of the arguments over the network. We also need to send some sort of way of identifying the function being called, because we're going to have not just one possible function call, but like any library, we're probably going to have a whole bunch of functions we're going to be able to call. So part of what we're going to send over network here is going to be an identifier for what functions are called. And when we're returning, we're going to have to send the return value, and this is sort of converted to bytes. Or we might have to send a failure indication. So as we'll talk a little bit more about later, one thing that could happen here is like maybe like you asked me to call a function I don't have. In a compiled program, we'd learn that because it wouldn't link. You know, we wouldn't be able to get a binary. In this system, you know, we have to figure that out at runtime. So questions about this sort of high-level data flow. And probably most importantly, what our stubs are. Okay, so since we have sort of what the high-level data flow looks like, let me show you sort of what actual code using an RPC system might look like. And I'm going to show you code using gRPC. This is a Google-developed RPC system, hence the G. And I have chosen this because this is what we're going to use in our assignment. You might notice that it looks like gRPC has made some choices which maybe are not the most transparent. They have decided that it wasn't worth making it look precisely like a normal local function call. And we'll talk about the details of this later, but let's sort of go over sort of the big things that are going on here. So on the server side, we have the server code on the bottom here, the server and the client code at the top, and the client code at the top. So let's start with the client, sorry. So on the client, you know, our local function call, this is Python code. Yes, the last assignment is in Python. Might look like this. If we're taking advantage of Python's ability to have named arguments, you can see we kind of have this extra step here. This is just done to make implementing the RPC library in some sense more convenient. They could have gotten rid of this, but they decided that, you know, it would be more convenient to have this sort of extra step. But otherwise, it mostly looks like a local call, except we have this stub thing. We'll talk about that in a second. On the server side, normally we just define like make directory taking a path argument. Here, we have a whole bunch of extra stuff. We have a class, and we have this extra context argument. So, just some extra steps here. But otherwise, this is approximately what we write. The error handling is a little different, but it's approximately what we do locally. So, what about this extra stuff? So, one thing here is we have this stub in context. And, you know, why could we get rid of them? So, the gRPC library does have a bunch of extra stuff that maybe we don't need, but the stub in context are therefore a very good reason that we kind of can't get rid of. So the stub here is where we're providing the information about where's the server. I have to say, if I want to run something on a server, I have to somehow identify that server. This isn't like a local library where I know what function I'm running because when I compiled the program, I compiled that in. We're going to want to figure that out, you know, at runtime. What server am I talking to? And this dot, dot, dot code is where I provide that information. And the way gRPC designed their Python interface is that you get an object that has methods for each of the things you call, and this object stores the information about where's the server and so on. On the server side, there's extra information I might want about the function call. So this is not sort of strictly necessary, but for example, I might want to know, you know, what client called me, information like that. This context object gives me access to that from the server. And that's why gRPC added this, even though it's not kind of essential to how our function calls work, remote procedure calls work. As for this extra sort of step between arguments, gRPC made a choice that they did that not all RPC systems make, but they decided that to simplify their implementation, every remote procedure call takes exactly one arguments object. If you want to store multiple things in that, that's fine. But the idea is that this simplifies compatibility between different languages and versions and so on. So another thing you might notice here is that we have this sort of this class. So what is this class doing here? And the way gRPC decided to organize their server stub, remember the code that calls the server functions, is that they define a base class where the way you tell gRPC where are the server functions I want you to call is that you make a subclass of this base class and pass an instance of that subclass to the library. And that's how the library knows where all your classes are, all your functions you want it to call are. So this is an implementation choice they made. They could have done other things. This is actually a fairly convenient way of being able to tell the library, hey, here's the make directory function I want to call remotely. Okay. So questions about sort of what we've seen in this example code. So we've seen sort of how the usage is going to end up being. And let's talk about what things we need to do when implementing this. So an important step is sending the arguments and the return values over the network. And this is called either marshaling or serialization. This is a vocab term for just translating to something we can like store in a file or send over the network. And you might say, well, just copy the arguments that are stored as bytes into what you send over the network. And there's two big reasons why that's not going to work out very well. So one reason is that we have pointers or references, and we can't just copy that directly as bytes. If I copy a pointer from my local machine and send it to a remote machine, the remote machine doesn't have the same thing at that memory address. I need to actually copy what the pointer points to, or else it's not going to know. Another issue is that commonly we want to do remote procedure calls between machines that are running different architectures. So, for example, I might want to have an app on my mobile phone that contacts a big server, and I want to use this RPC interface. And these different machines might have different ways that the arguments are actually laid out in memory. And so because of this, we're often going to have to do a lot more work than just taking the bytes of the argument and sending them over the network. We're going to have to choose a format carefully and take into account, like, what are they actually? And usually to do this, RPC libraries require you to tell them what the arguments are, and you might think, okay, so like I give them my header file or my Python file that defines the server methods, and that's typically not how it works. Typically, they have what's called an interface description language. So they have a separate file with a separate sort of mini language that you as the server author use to specify your functions. And you might say, why isn't it good enough to just give normal source code? Because that is a real thing you could do often. Like, you could imagine instead getting like a C header file and figuring that out. But there are problems with just doing that. And the big issue is that usually when we have our like header files or equivalent, that doesn't have quite enough information. And you can think, like, so let's think of like C or C++, what information would we be missing? And I can give some examples. So one example is, let's say I had a function call with a char star. We might say, okay, that's an array. Is it null terminated? How do I know its size? That's not going to be necessarily in my header file, but that's really important for sending those arguments over the network. Or I might have like an int array pointer that I pass to a C++ function. Where is the size stored? That's not going to be in my header file, and so I need some other way of specifying it. Or maybe I'm passing a pointer to a function, and does that mean I'm modifying it or not? If I'm modifying it, then the RPC library to implement that actually needs to pass it as a return value, kind of implicitly. And that information is not going to be in my sort of header file. There's also issues of like memory allocation and deallocation. If I have like a function, you know, that returns a char star, when is that char star supposed to be deallocated somewhere? Who is supposed to do that? Like, I can't tell from just what's going to be in the header file. Okay. So we just don't have complete information in a typical header file or other sort of, you know, prototype, you know, information that you have in your normal programming language to actually do what our RPC library needs to do. And you could imagine maybe one approach would be give it a header file, but add a little extra stuff. But typically, that's not what they've done. Typically, they've defined their own little description language. I'll show you what gRPCs look like in order for you to specify, here are the function calls. Now, if it was just the case that we had these problems, I think most RPC libraries would have settled on the give us a header file, but add a few extra things. But there's two other big concerns besides whether the information in the header file is enough that make it so it's really attractive to have this sort of separate way of specifying what the remote procedure calls are. So one issue is machine and language neutrality. So if I have like a function that takes a long, that means different things on different platforms. And I want to specify what should be supported in a way which is going to be the same on all platforms. And also, a common goal of these RPC systems is to be language neutral. So for example, we're going to be using gRPC from Python. gRPC supports all sorts of programming languages. And one of the things it lets you do is that you could write a RPC server in Python and call it from C++. But if we're doing that, then we have to specify this takes a string, for example, your function takes a string, and make sure that passing works correctly. And so to be language neutral, these RPC systems will define like their own idea of what's a string and make sure they map it to something that makes sense in every single language. And it makes sense to have sort of a separate language for that rather than having, you know, you individually look up how it maps. You just write the, it's a string, and strings are accessed in a different way for each language, rather than you looking at the C++ declaration saying, what does this map to in Python? Another big reason is that often we have a server that keeps running for a long time, and we want to upgrade clients or upgrade the server without them being in sync. And this is something we don't have with libraries. With a library, if I want to upgrade the library, I have to relink my application, you know, and probably recompile if the header file's changed. But if the header file equivalent changed for our server, well, my client could still be running as we're changing the server. And because of that, a common goal in these RPC systems is to define what should happen if the server gets upgraded and the client doesn't, or vice versa. And one way they can help do this is by defining their format for RPC calls to be flexible in a way that lets us, you know, make it clear, like, if the server has an extra argument, what is that, what happens? Now, we can, like, define that by adding extra meta information about, you know, that tells us what should happen when we have different versions. So questions about these reasons for using an interface description language? Okay. So let's look at an example of what the interface description language might look like. So here's how it might look like for gRPCs. Interface description language. So we define a message type, which is kind of like a struct. And then we have a value here in that struct, which is a string called path. And I have this equals one, and we'll look at that in a sec. And I also define a service. A service is something an RPC server would be running. And here's a function call, a remote procedure call that provides. It takes makedirargs as its argument. Remember, gRPC made this choice to only use one argument to keep things simpler. And returns something called empty as its result. So now when I make a function call, we have to translate this into bytes using this information. And I'm giving an example possible format. I'm not showing you what gRPC actually does because that's complicated for reasons that we don't really have time to go into. So one possibility here is we might translate this into a call to, a call to where we send the function name. And if I'm sending the function name, I need to say, how long is it? So I've just chosen in this format to send before the function name a byte with the length of the string make directory. And then I need to send the arguments. And gRPC has these numbers for each element of these sort of messages. And so what I'm doing here is I'm sending the number followed by the length of that string there, followed by the actual string contents. So this is a format I've chosen. There are other things I could have done. I could have used null terminated strings instead of lengths, but we need to choose something. And one observation to make about this numbering here is, since I numbered this argument, if I wanted to add a new numbered argument, I can do that later on, and we'd still know what's going on, even if the server didn't know about that, you know, argument number two. Also, if I want to change the name of this argument from path to like file name, I can do that, and it doesn't change the format on the network, and that's by design. So those are the two reasons why gRPC has chosen to have this numbering here. And that sort of thing is actually a pretty common feature in RPC systems, that they'll let you specify something about how something's identified on the network so you can, you know, change names or support adding extra things later on without disrupting older code. So questions about this example here? Apologies for people calling me when they should not. Okay. So let's do a fuller version of this example, of gRPC example, now that we've talked about this works. So here's sort of a fuller version of that IDL that we had. So you can see I have my arguments objects. I've just defined a new one for each method. The reason why is because this way I can easily add additional arguments if I want them for each of these make directory and list directory remote procedure calls. I have my definition of empty because I need to return something. That's just a rule gRPC made. And I have some directory entries here. I have two fields. And you see each of them has a name. So each of these messages are going to turn into in C++ or Python classes. And it's going to generate code to marshal and demarshal them, meaning convert them to and from bytes and accessors. And this is actually part of a library gRPC uses called protocol buffers, which you could use without RPC if you want to send, you just want to write things as bytes. We have the numbering, which I mentioned is to allow us to change the field names or add new fields without us getting confused about what happens. Then we have our actual methods and their arguments and return values, which are always one of these messages. So a single argument, but it's a struct basically. So we can put whatever we want in it. And a single return value, but it's a struct, so we can put whatever we want in it. Then we have our actual implementation. So this is a separate file. We compile that and we get a bunch of code. If I'm using Python, I compile this to a bunch of Python code. So the first thing I'm going to do when I use it is I'm going to import that Python code. So in this example, you know, I have these two Python files. So these were generated from dirproto.proto, which was our IDL file. So it generated these two Python files, which I'm just importing. And these Python files contain, among other things, we have a base class. I know some of you aren't very familiar with Python object orientation. This is basically a way of defining a class directories impl, which is a subclass of directory servicer. And this is saying this is our base class, which is from this file I imported. So there's some code generated from the IDL, which defined this base class for me. And I, to implement the make directory method, override the make directory method in my subclass. And the Python convention is that the first argument is the this pointer, and then I have my request argument and this context. And here I'm doing some debug prints, calling make directory. And I have this context argument, which gives me access to sort of special RPC functionality. And here I'm using that to return an error in a way supported by the RPC system. I could have thrown an exception, but this gives me more control and also makes it clearer what happens in other programming languages, you know, which is why we want to have a separate way of returning, you know, exceptions, because what if this is called from, you know, C? We don't have exceptions in C. How do my exception map? If I'm doing this, I know exactly how it's going to map to that, the C version of this call. And then I return when I'm done. I have to return something because that's just a rule gRPC made. I also have my sort of the second method here. This is my list directory method. Here I'm returning a result that is sort of a list. And notice that I have this directory list return type, and I just append things to it and then return them. If we go back to our IDL, we see directory list, we had this repeated, and that's a way that gRPC has for saying this is an array inside the struct. And you can see the array in Python looks like a Python list, so we add to it like it was a Python list. And that's done by all this generated code. So questions about sort of our server implementation from the sort of file. Everyone's very quiet. Okay. So now I have to find my server class. I somehow need to start a server with this. And in gRPC, the way this is done is that we create a server object and we specify where does it actually execute the remote procedure calls. And the way way I'm doing this in this example is I'm saying use a thread pool with three threads. And basically what the server is going to do is that when it gets a function call from a remote machine, it's going to submit a task to this thread pool to actually run that function call. And once I create the server object, I need to tell it about my implementation class where I subclass it and, you know, subclass their base class and define the make directories and list directories methods that are going to be called remotely. So here I'm creating an object of that class and passing that object to this function that knows how to add it to the server, except I forgot the server argument, which is very important. And then I tell the server, hey, I want you to run on this host and port number. There's also a way of specifying that we'll use in the assignment, like a local socket. But we need to specify where is the server going to expect the client to connect to. And then we start it, and it runs in a separate thread. So this is the server side. So how does the client side look? So on the client side, we're going to use the same generated code. So I'm importing the generated code, and I create what gRPC calls a channel to specify this is where the server I want to connect to is, and I create a stub class using that information. And then using that stub class, I call a method on that class, and that actually goes to the server and makes a function call there. And gRPC has made a choice that all errors are going to turn into Python exceptions when you're calling it from Python. If you're calling it from something like C, there's no exceptions, so they'll do something different. And here I have an example where I'm ignoring the return value. I also could call something with the return value and then use the return value, you know, using that generated code for the, in this case, the directory list return value type. Okay, so those are examples. We're going to have an assignment where we use that, which is our last assignment. And looking at these examples, we can see that there are a bunch of things, some of which are very obvious, where it's not actually like a local function call. But it's still pretty convenient, and therefore actually a very common thing in industry. So the big thing that wasn't transparent, that was really obvious, is the setup wasn't transparent. We had this extra code up here where we had to specify what server to do. Like, ideally, the system would just know what we want, but that doesn't make sense in most applications. Something which is less obvious is errors. So let's say I unplug my network cable while I'm running this. What's going to happen? This is a new type of error. We can't happen locally. A third issue that's not obvious is what's going to happen if the client and server are out of sync. What if I add an argument to make directory at the server and my client doesn't know about that? What's going to happen? And, you know, this is something which either we're going to get something going wrong, or we're going to have to write code probably on the server to detect, oh, the client didn't specify this newer argument. I'm going to make a default for it because it didn't have the right version. And another big difference, which isn't obvious from this, is the performance is very different from local. So a local procedure call is like maybe less than, you know, 100 nanoseconds. A remote call is probably, is often like more than a millisecond. Maybe 10 to hundreds of milliseconds if you have a really great network. Have a great network. So it's a lot slower. So questions about these sort of advantages, disadvantages. Okay. So another last thing about RPC, like with sockets, it's actually not uncommon to use RPC locally. You know, just because it's maybe a more convenient alternative to pipes or sockets is using RPC. And there are things you can do when using it locally that maybe are faster than what you would do with the traditional implementation. So one thing you could imagine is you can do a shared memory implementation, where, for example, you could communicate, it looks like remote procedure calls, but it's really implemented not with sockets, but with like mutexes and condition variables in a queue. Okay, so that's me finishing up RPC. So last questions on RPC. Because our next topic is we're going to talk about failure. So I mentioned errors might happen. There's these new types of failure. And our next big topic is going to be how do we actually deal intelligently with those failures? And to think about that, we're going to need to think about, well, how do things fail? And there's lots of ways, and we're going to kind of look at a limited set of those failures, because if we didn't do that, we kind of have no options, right? If things could fail in any way, well, there's nothing we can do. So I'm going to start by talking about sort of network failures, and we're going to be concerned about these two kinds of network failures. You might say, good at the network, garble my message. That's not on this list, yes, but we have ways of working around that by checksumming the messages. So we're just going to be concerned about what if our network loses messages, so we send a message and it doesn't get there. Like, I'm sending it over Wi-Fi, I suddenly walked away too far away from my hotspot, doesn't get there. And we also have cases where messages get delayed and reordered. So this is less obvious. Why would this happen? So I can think of some reasons why. So one reason why is that when we deal with messages being lost, we're going to resend them, and resending them can delay or reorder them. Another reason why is that if I have multiple ways of reaching a machine. Like, if this is my internet to, I guess, my internet cloud here, so this is the client server, then messages that go on this path versus messages that end up going on this path are going to take different amounts of time, so you'll end up being reordered. So they're both two big reasons why you might get big delays on real networks. So let's talk about how we can deal with these problems. Let's start with messages being lost. So we can deal with this, well, with acknowledgments. And we can recover by retrying. So the natural thing, if my message is lost, you know, if I send something in the mail and it doesn't get there, we'll send it again. And that's what we're going to do for this. We're going to say, we're going to retry, but we have to know we need to retry. So we're going to ask for an acknowledgement that, yes, I got that message. Now, an unfortunate thing about this scheme that we're going to see, it's kind of annoying, is that we can't distinguish between different types of failures here. So we can't tell, you know, I don't get an acknowledgement back. Was the original message lost or was my acknowledgement lost? I can't actually tell. And that's too bad. So I can't distinguish between was my acknowledgement lost or acknowledgement lost. So let's look at that. So, or wait, no, let's not look at that yet. We'll forget that. But we'll see that we can't tell if we distinguish between that. The other thing is that I can't tell whether the machine crashed or my message or the network's bad. Like, I can't tell the difference between the two. And that's just going to be something we're inevitably going to have to deal with. So this acknowledgement scheme, so this idea of, like, just ask for confirmation sounds like straightforward. But because of these sort of this problem that I can't distinguish between these situations, we get, you know, some results which maybe aren't so great. So let's think of this in the context of RPC. So I make an RPC call, make a directory foo. And one option here is that there's no acknowledgments. The client sub just sends the message, doesn't wait for a return value, and just says, yes, I sent it, and returns. And as long as it doesn't throw an exception, it means it sent it successfully, as far as it knows. And the other option is the client gets an acknowledgement from the server that says okay and tells you when it happens. And let's just assume there's only network failures. So I mentioned we might have to worry, what if the machine goes down? Let's say there's only network failures. And an important question here is, well, I made this call to make a directory. What could the directory have been created or not if something happens? So I have two options here. If it throws an exception, you know, could the directory have been created in each of these cases? If it throws no exception, could the directory have not been created in each of these cases? So these are both things where, if either of these are true, we're disappointed that our RPC system, despite, you know, with each of these designs, and we might think the acknowledgement one should be better, so that kind of failed us, that it didn't actually tell us what happened. Okay, I'll give another, 20 seconds. Okay, so we have consensus on this and this, and I agree with that. So quickly, so if we wait for the server to return okay, it could have been the case that the server made our directory and then the network went down. That's something which could have happened, in which case, net down we're making. A lot of people think, I think it depends on the details of when our client stub throws exceptions, but I think most commonly it would mean that probably we haven't sent enough to the server for the server to do it, but, I could see cases where maybe, the exception is detected after we send enough to make the function call happen. So the question is, can we get an exception after enough is sent, enough is queued to send? And the answer is maybe. And then we have here, if we don't get an exception, could it have not been created? And the answer is definitely yes. The server might not have gotten it because we sent it on the network and the network lost it. Lost our message. For B, I think, assuming it must have been created, assuming the server created the directory before replying. You might say maybe the server replied when it got the message, but didn't wait till it creates the directory, but hopefully didn't do that. Okay, so questions about sort of these scenarios. So what entity is throwing an exception? The RPC library. And the RPC library could be throwing an exception because it got a message saying the remote machine threw an exception, or could just be, instead of okay, or more likely it's throwing it because something went wrong locally. Like it was trying to set up a socket and it didn't work. Does that answer your question? Yeah, and that's typically what we're dealing with, especially with option A, where presumably we don't wait for the server. And so it seems like this return okay solution, probably better. We have this problem here that we could not get a response and the directory is created, but that's kind of okay. Eventually we'll figure out the directory was there. But there's some cases where the operation isn't like make directory, and this might not be such a good idea. So let's say I asked to append to a file, and I can't tell whether it actually got appended. So I add acknowledgements. Great. I don't get an acknowledgement. What do I do? Well, I repeat it. And, I can't really tell if I want to repeat it, because in this case, I don't want to repeat it. I didn't get my, I appended to the file reply. I didn't. So sort of our solution to this is that we want to retry in a way where we say append, but only if you haven't already. So this is sort of how we're going to deal with that repeat, is we just need some way of repeating that's idempotent. And this is sort of the same issue we had with our redo logs. We want to make sure we're going to redo this operation of telling you to do it. We want to do it in a way which, works. Now, there's a last question here, which is, you know, okay, let's say we didn't get a reply the next time, but we're going to try again. When do we give up? And that's, there's not a good answer, right? Maybe the machine got thrown in the trash. Do we keep retrying forever? So that's sort of a hard question. So this was dealing with messages being lost. So our solution for messages being lost is get an acknowledgement, keep retrying until we get that acknowledgement, and make sure when we retry, we do so in a way where we avoid repeating operations we shouldn't repeat. Like if we're appending to a file, we have some way of saying, append if you haven't already, rather than just append. So we don't like get the operation doubled. So the second issue I mentioned is what if the messages are ordered, reordered? And connection protocols deal with this problem, and RPCs don't, right? Because RPCs are independent, so you could imagine I send two RPC calls, they go separate in separate connections, I get them at different times. Even though they were made in a particular order, I get them in another order. And note that we can't tell the difference between messages being lost or delayed. Now, but dealing with messages being reordered is actually fairly simple. We can use sequence numbers. And this is basically what connection protocols do. So if I went to send hello world split across two messages with my connection protocol, or if I'm doing it manually, I just send hello, this is part one, and world, this is part two. So when machine B gets them in a different order because the network was, you know, acting funny, it can put them back in order. And it can even send an acknowledgement saying, yes, I got both parts. And sort of that's how we deal with reorder. So we have our two techniques for dealing with network failures, that the ones we care about here, which was for messages being lost, ask for acknowledgements, for messages being reordered, mark them with numbers so we can put them back together in the right order. So then we have a question of machine failures. So I talked about how networks fail, and we're going to want to deal with machines failing. And if you remember when we talked about why we do distributed systems, a big reason was we had this hope that by having multiple machines, we'd be able to handle one machine going down and still have the whole system work. But to think about how we do this, we need to think about, like, what does it mean for a machine to fail? And there are two big models people use for this. So one is a model that we'll mostly be talking about, which is called fail-stop. That when a machine fails, it's going to fail by not responding or not getting messages. Or alternately, maybe it doesn't do that, but we can detect it's broken and just ignore it. The other common model is something known as Byzantine failures. And in the Byzantine failure model, the failing machines do the worst possible thing. So, like, they will send, like, contradictory messages. They'll say, yep, I created that directory, and not create the directory. And if they're doing the worst possible thing, obviously this is a lot harder to deal with. So we're not going to talk much about how to deal with this type of failure beyond mentioning that there are models for doing it, and we're going to need, like, more redundancy to handle that. We're going to mostly talk about this fail-stop model. So with this fail-stop model, basically, when our machine fails, it goes down, and hopefully it comes back up later and is usable again. And our goal is going to be to recover when that machine or machines come back up. And we're going to talk about how to do that in the context of doing an operation together on multiple machines. And so this is sort of what, you know, our main topic that we're going to talk about. So there's another model, you know, sort of where the, you know, the continuous availability model, not main topic. So this would cover machine competence, main topic, and also is in the assignment and not in the assignment. Is this idea of a quorum of machines working. That If we have extra machines that can do the same thing, then we could handle a failure by having extra machines that have a copy of all the relevant information that could replace the failed machines. And the tricky thing is just making sure that, you know, we go to the right one. So we might talk very briefly about that. We probably won't for time reasons. So we're going to mainly talk about, you know, assuming that when things fail, we're not going to have, you know, we're going to have a temporary loss of availability. Meaning that when a machine fails, yes, the website's not going to work. But what we're going to talk about how to do is making sure that our distributed system comes back in a consistent state. So let's look at this sort of idea of recovering. And to recover, we need to say, what do we want to recover into? And we need to think about, like, what are these machines doing? So I'm going to talk about an abstract way to say, what is our distributed system actually doing as a set of, what I'll call, distributed transactions. So with redo logging, we talked about this idea of a transaction where some operation, which had multiple components, happens all at once or not at all. A distributed transaction is the same thing, except the operations components are split across multiple machines. And the idea is the two machines will do it or not do it. The whole thing will happen or not, even if a machine fails. And our primary goal, like with redo logging, is going to be a consistent state. That if we have a crash, we want to have things be in a consistent state. We don't want this operation that's split across the multiple machines to be half done. A secondary goal is that if nothing breaks, we want the operation to actually happen. Why do I have that secondary goal? So you don't propose stupid solutions like always give up. And, you know, we're going to want to do this in spite of failures, meaning that when a machine fails, when it comes back up, we want to get back to a consistent state, just like with redo logging on a local file system when we rebooted. We wanted to get back to a consistent state. That consistent state might not include everything we were trying to do. Like if we crashed while renaming a file, the rename might not have happened, but at least it won't have half happened. Now you might say, okay, what are these two machines going to be doing together? And one example of this sort of problem is with a distributed database. So let's say I want to store our course database across multiple machines because it's too big. And I've decided to split up my machines. I have three machines. I've split them up in this way. Machines A and B have records for every student, and machine C have records for every course. And there's some redundancy here. So the student records tell us what courses each student is in, and the course records tell us what students are in those courses. Which means that when we want to add a student to a course, we need to edit both one of the machines with student records and the machine with course records. And our consistency problem is that if a machine crashes and comes back up, we don't want to be confused about who's in what course. So we're going to talk about how do we implement this. And a key thing that we're going to take advantage of is that when we have failures, it's going to be okay to say no. We're going to say, sorry, I can't add you to the course now. Try again later. In a real system, this retrying would hopefully be like automated. But that's how we're going to deal with the worst case. If things are broken, we're going to say, it's not available right now. Try later. Now, let's see why this is a hard problem by looking at sort of a simple example here. So let's say, here's my proposed procedure. You know, we want to edit the course and student records, so I'm going to execute code on the machine where the student records are stored. That machine's going to make an RPC or some other call to machine C with the course records, say, add the student to the course, get a response back, and then add the student locally. Okay? And so this sounds like it would work, but this has some problems with consistency. guess I was going to ask a quiz question. So this has problems with consistency, even if we have no failures. So the problem is, if I ask who's in the course, who is in the course here, get conflicting answers. That if I ask right at this point in time, when C is adding the student to the course, I find out on the student's end, the student's not in the course. On the course's end, the student is in the course. So I don't have consistency, even with no failures. So this is one thing we're going to want to fix. And this is not even considering what if, you know, machine B goes down after it tells the C. That's even worse. So we're going to have to fix that too. So we'll talk about how we do that next time. Okay, so before I finish up today, questions on this example?